Maybe they let me hold the little guy. So 1 Corinthians 11. You know, probably the biggest struggle with our text last week, at least for me, was that our friend Paul was talking about something that us modern Americans just don't know much about. I mean, we know what head coverings are, but they're not part of our culture. They're not really part of our American tradition. And since Paul didn't feel the need to explain head covering etiquette for us, you and me are just kind of left to piece things together as best we can. Well, in our passage today, which starts in verse 17, the issue Paul's dealing with, at least the underlying issue, is something us modern Christians know a lot about. And that is our inclination to bring the outside culture into the church. Y'all, this shows up everywhere. It's in the way we do music. It's in the way we decorate our buildings. It's even in the way we approach ministry and teach the Bible. And I like to think that most of the time, it comes from a good place. You know, we want to reach as many people as we can, right? With the gospel message. We want to create an environment where people feel comfortable to interact with Jesus and His church. And so we bring what's familiar, even popular, out there into here. I remember when we were building this place and the interior walls started going up, and Adam, who was the lead contractor, great dude, he told us that he needed the paint colors that we had picked out for the walls because he needed to get the paint ordered. And we had a team that decided all that stuff. Me and Pastor Dennis didn't want any part of that. And so we let the team know, and they brought in the color swatches, and they were like, okay, this is for the walls, and this is for the trim, and well, y'all see what they pick. But I remember afterwards a conversation I had with Pam Kruer. Y'all remember Miss Pam. She was on that team who picked those colors, and I said, Miss Pam, I thought we were going to paint everything dark, like especially the ceiling. And she just looked at me and said, Mike, why on earth would we do that? And I was like, well, that's what all the big churches do. You know, they keep it dark so they can manipulate the lighting and they can really set the... And as I was talking, I kind of realized how stupid I sounded. I realized what I was trying to do. I was trying to bring the outside culture into the church. And it was left up to me. This place would have looked like a concert venue. I miss Pam and Tom. Well, no, I miss Pam. Tom, not so much. But. I'm kidding. I miss them both a lot. But you see, what I was doing this and not even realizing I was doing this, you know, and I think that's what I mean when I think it comes from a good place. We're not trying to be anti anything. We're just trying to open things up to as many people as possible. And our thinking kind of goes along the lines, well, this is what the culture seems to like, so let's do that here in the church. But y'all, that's not what the church is supposed to do. The church is supposed to shape the culture, not the other way around. But unfortunately, it ends up happening a lot where the culture influences the church. And that happened in Corinth. It got so bad that it warranted a response from Paul. He told them in verse 17 that when they gather together, that their gatherings actually weren't for the better, but they were for the worse. So while it was a really good thing that they were coming together like they were supposed to, if they were going to keep doing what they were doing, it actually would have been better for them to just stay at home. So what are they doing that's so bad? Great question. Let's look at verse 20. We'll see what they were doing. Paul writes, "When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? You losers." That is such a wild passage there. I think it needs a little backstory. So the early church, the Young Jesus movement, when they gathered for worship and for sharing, they also wanted to fellowship. They wanted to enjoy each other's company, too. Because for a lot of the first Christians, especially Jewish Christians, the church had become their family. Because if you were part of a deeply Orthodox Jewish family and you became a Christian, you were often put out of your family. So when Jesus talked about his followers losing their families because of him, he was serious about that. That happened a lot. And so after the local church worshiped Jesus together, they'd often sit together and share a meal, just like we do from time to time. So you see, that whole practice, the covered dish luncheon, didn't originate with the Baptist church. We just perfected it, right? I heard somebody say one time that every good Baptist should own a copy of the King James Bible and a 13x9 casserole dish. And I think that's so true. But y'all, this practice goes all the way back to Acts chapter 2 and the beginning of the church. In verse 46, Luke tells us that day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts. And you know, back then, this wasn't like an official church event. It was just something that they did. The church was born in Jerusalem, right? And who lived in Jerusalem? Jewish people. And for their entire history as a people, going back to the Exodus, table fellowship has been such a huge part of Jewish culture. To share a meal with someone was to accept them into your home and to invite friendship. And so now these faithful Jews are part of Jesus' new family, and so continuing that tradition just made sense. But like most things that start out simple and meaningful, it turned into something else. Something Paul feels strong enough about to correct here in chapter 11. And by the time we get to Paul's letter, this fellowship actually has a name. It's called a love feast. Now, Paul never refers to it as that, and that may be because love feast is just a very cringy name to give to something. But we know from other sources that that's what they called it. The New Testament writer Jude, who was Jesus' half-brother, he mentions the love feast in verse 12 of his letter. And so now in Corinth, this meaningful fellowship has become something altogether different. And what that is something gross. It's gross, but it's familiar. You see, these communal type meals were common in ancient Corinth. Again, this is a context thing. People from different professions, different social classes, different economic classes would eat together fairly often in ancient Corinth. And y'all know where they did that at? Those temples, those pagan temples. But as you can imagine, at a pagan temple, pretty much anything goes. There really are no rules of etiquette. So what you would have is the wealthier people, because they're wealthy, they would bring more food. They could purchase more food from the markets at the temple. And the poorer people, well, they're poor, right? And they don't have much. They sure can't afford to eat out at the temple. They're not like poor people today who seem to be able to eat out all the time. But so this dynamic of the wealthy and the poor, this dynamic was now in the church. And it became this very ugly scene where the more affluent folks, they were just throwing down, y'all. And the poorer Christians, they were almost shunned and ignored by their wealthier brothers and sisters. Paul says in 21 that each one went ahead with his own meal, meaning they just show up, they sit down, and they get after it. They don't even wait on their brothers and sisters. And what's worse is they're not even sharing. I mean, the idea of a covered dish is everybody brings something and we all share, right? We get to try each other's casseroles and mac and cheese. And if you can't bring much, that's okay. There's plenty to go around. But that's not what's happening here. Here you've got some folks going hungry while other folks are getting drunk. It's a disgrace, y'all. It's an absolute disgrace. And it makes Paul so mad. He asks them, do you fools not have houses you can do that stuff in? Why do you even bring that to the gatherings? He tells them in verse 33, when y'all come together to eat, wait for each other to get there. Just wait. That's all you got to do. And if you're so hungry, you don't think you can wait, eat something at home before you come. It's like those family members who show up at the reunion with a bag of wavy Lays and some hot dog buns, you know? No hot dogs, just buns, right? And they eat everything. They're so rude, they don't even wait for everybody to get food before they start making their to-go plates to take home. We all know them. Some of us are them, but that's another conversation for another day. And y'all, what the believers in Corinth are doing is bad enough by itself. But the fact that these love feasts were so often connected to the Lord's Supper, and that this is the behavior of God's church when they share a communal meal with Him. Think about that. It's no wonder Paul is as livid as he is. The Lord's Supper is supposed to be a very simple yet very serious and spiritually heavy ritual. You should at least be sober, right? Can we start there? Is that the baseline? I mean, these folks are treating the Lord's Supper like an appetizer or like light refreshments that don't really have any meaning. Paul even asked them at the end of verse 22, "Do you despise the church of God? Is that why you do what you do? Would you humiliate your brothers and sisters who have nothing?" And let's assume that the Corinthians weren't aware of how egregious their actions were, okay? Does that make them any less wrong? No. And Paul needs them to know that. Because this isn't a struggle they need to work through and try to do better next time. This is a moral crime against a sacred ritual that they need to fix now. This has to stop. And I really appreciate how Paul chooses to persuade them, because he's went after them pretty hard, but he doesn't keep punching down on them anymore. He wants to get their eyes up. He doesn't want them dwelling on their sin. He wants them to acknowledge it, but he wants them to move forward. He wants them focused on Jesus. He says in verse 23, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" So, the Last Supper that Jesus shared with his closest friends was a communal meal. It was a Passover meal. Now, Passover in the Jewish tradition stands above all other feasts and festivals. This is the holy day that unites all of Israel, both religious and non-religious, because it bonds families and communities together to their origin as a people who were set apart. Remember, before Israel was a nation with borders, they were a people. And the traditional Passover meal for these special people is referred to as a Seder. It's a Hebrew word that means order, because the Passover meal has a specific order that the food gets eaten, the prayers get prayed, and the songs get sung. It's the total opposite of what's going on in Corinth, where it's just a free-for-all. And Jesus took parts of this sacred meal, and he instituted a new sacred meal using the bread and the wine that we call the Lord's Supper. The bread he referred to as his body. It was baked without leaven, which is really just yeast. So it didn't rise. It was flat, like a tortilla. And since all that heat was concentrated on this thin, flat bread, it scorched it and it burned through it in places. So when you looked at the bread, it looked like it had scars, like Jesus has scars. And the traditional Seder had 4 cups of wine. You drink them at different points during the meal. And tradition teaches that at this Last Supper, Jesus used two of the four cups to initiate this new covenant. He picked up the first cup, which is known as the cup of sanctification, and he told his friends to each drink from this cup because this was now theirs. This was now theirs. Their allegiance to Jesus and their participation in this new covenant made them clean and holy. They were being sanctified as part of this new covenant. After that, he picked up the scarred bread and he said, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And he broke the bread and he shared it with his disciples. Then after the bread, the third cup was poured, which was the cup of redemption. And according to Luke 22, Jesus says, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Do this in remembrance of me." Y'all, this is our sacrament. This is our covenantal meal. And this is what some folks in Corinth were dishonoring, which is why Paul says in verse 30 that many of them are weak and sick, and some have even died. Going back to verse 27, Paul said, "Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself." The Lord's Supper, or communion as it's also referred to, it isn't some secret handshake or clubhouse password or anything like that. This is Jesus' body broken for us. This is the new covenant in His blood. And y'all, it's not just what the Lord's Supper calls us to remember, it's also what it wants us to look forward to. Paul says in verse 26, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes." Until He comes. Jesus is coming again. Do we believe that? Jesus died to free us from the bondage of sin and death, to rescue us from hell. And He's coming back to take us home to heaven. And these folks ignore all of that and just treat it as some type of dinner party for themselves. They want to hog all the chicken wings and not share them with their brothers and sisters. They want to treat this event, this sacred meal, like it's some type of pagan temple party. And it's easy for us to kind of look down at that, but, you know, Corinthians aren't the only ones who get this wrong. And maybe I shouldn't say this, I'll blame it on the meds later. But I wonder if, because we haven't seen someone drop dead with a communion cup in their hand, that we feel it's okay to ignore Paul's warnings about eating and drinking judgment on ourselves. Y'all, one of my most favorite things to do is to watch families take communion together. It fills my heart up. I absolutely love it. But over the years, I've also watched several people partake of the Lord's Supper who I knew had no business approaching this table. Had no business whatsoever. And honestly, I'm not sure what to do about that. I'm being honest here. I don't know. Because Paul doesn't say, have the pastor examine you, does he? He says, let a person examine themselves. Then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. And y'all, we've had conversations with some of those people after the fact. And most of them just end up leaving the church and going to another one because that's what we do nowadays. So I don't know what to do about that. I mean, you're just trying to help people, right? You don't want folks drinking judgment on themselves. Nobody wants that. But I wonder if it's just part of the bigger problem. That for a lot of people, Christianity has become a cultural thing, not a deeply personal thing. It's why so many people like to check the Christian box, but they don't want the Christian life. They don't want to place themselves under the authority of Jesus because that means their life and their lifestyle would need to change. They'd have to acknowledge that all the money sitting in their bank accounts is not just theirs to enjoy. Financial blessings come down to us from the Father of lights. Every good gift comes down from the Father of lights. So the financial blessings come down to us so they can be shared through us. That's what we mean by open-handed living. When God puts the blessings in our hands, we don't close tight and hoard it all up for ourselves. We leave our hands open so that some of that blessing can slip through our fingers down to other people. Too many church folks are walking around with really tight fists, holding on to everything. They'll check the box, but they won't write the check because they don't want the life. Our personal involvement in the ministry of our local churches tells the same story, y'all. Someone being active in a local church used to mean that that person gathered for worship weekly and was involved in the lives of their brothers and sisters. There was an investment being made. Now, all a person need do is attend a worship service once a month, and they're considered active according to current standards. That is such a joke. That is so bad, I don't even know where to start. Following Jesus requires commitment and sacrifice. It always has. That is the faithful testimony of Jesus' early followers. It will never be anything else. But you know, if I can just check the box, y'all, much like Israel, church is not a place, it's a people. It's a people. And if we're not part of the people, we're not part of the church. But I go once a month. Congratulations. You're a tourist, you're not a citizen. And y'all, I understand that the rhythms of our modern world are different than they used to be. I get that. A lot of folks work on Sundays. People work nights. People work out of town. They're super busy. I get all that. I get all that. But the church is not just the church on Sundays. I think that's part of the problem. We think as long as we make it to one of these every now and then, we're fulfilling our duty. But the work of discipleship and evangelism and charity does not just happen on Sundays. These are holy pursuits that we are to chase in some form every day of our lives. Because every day of our lives we should be pursuing Jesus, and these are the things He is doing. He is drawing people to Himself. He is working in the lives of His followers. He is using His followers to bring good into the lives of others. He is doing this every day, not just on Sunday. Jesus is our life. Jesus is the reason we have life. His kingdom is our purpose, y'all. His glory is our pursuit, individually and collectively as a local church. In Philippians 3, Paul calls us citizens of heaven. I love that. Citizens of heaven. He doesn't call us tourists. He calls us citizens. And as citizens, we watch the skies looking for our Savior to return. But until that day, we have this, because this is ours, because this is His. It's ours because it's His. It's the Lord's Supper. And by observing this, we are proclaiming His death until He comes. We are sharing a common meal with our King until the day we share it with Him renewed in His Father's kingdom. And that'll be a glorious day. But until we have that, we have this. So please, please do not approach this table lightly or without reverence, because this is sacred. It's sacred. It's not magical. It's not even really mysterious. It's just sacred. It's special. It's different. It's holy. And it's for citizens only. Citizens whose sins are confessed and whose repentance is ongoing. That doesn't mean you're perfect. That means you're well aware of the fact that you're not. You need not be a member of Legacy to approach this table. We just need clean hands and we need pure hearts. So let's make sure that before we take part, that we take time to examine ourselves, as Paul says. Then and so eat the bread and drink the cup.